Karen Brown is a YouTuber, a quilter, crafter, mother, wife, daughter, businesswoman, but not necessarily in that order. Karen is the creator behind Just Get It Done Quilts, a name I love because it's all in how you say it, because it could just be like, just get it done quilts, or just get it done quilts.
I'm going with the less demanding version.
Nah, you don't know Karen. February 11th, 2018 was the fateful day that Karen opened the doors on her YouTube channel. She uploaded her very first video called Hazelnut Quilt Part 2. And just a few years later, she's managed to...
Wait.
Strange. I mean, there will be a follow-up question,
I think so.
Just a few years later, she's attracted over 30 million video views and has built a loyal audience of almost 380,000 subscribers. So let's find out how all of this has happened. Please welcome to the podcast, Karen Brown.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming here. So let's actually rewind to that point, because I think point one will be, why is it a part two video, which is the first video?
Gotta know. There's a story there.
Well, it's just a silly thing. It was part two. That Christmas, my husband got me a selfie stick. And we're talking about at the beginning of Instagram. Like, Instagram was a real cool place, and I wasn't on it, and I wanted to learn how to be on it. And I took a video of me tracing part one, basically tracing out this pattern on a piece of paper. And I put it on Instagram. And I think I maybe had 70 followers at the time, and it got seen by 400 people. So I thought, oh, videos are the way to go. And then I did that second part. And then, of course, I volunteered for my local quilt guild to do a challenge. And I decided I would do this challenge, and I would film it, how to do it, but not just how to do one, three different ways and three different sizes. Like, talk about overpromised. And I had no clue how to make a video. I had just had this 400 views on Instagram, and somehow I thought that qualified me to be a videographer.
Well, that was also the days before video had taken over Instagram.
Yes, yes. But I noted with that first video on Instagram that video did so much better than just a flat photo.
It wasn't that really loud guitar music that you included in the... Do you remember where you found that music, or was that just like part of the stock music?
I'm pretty sure it's just part of stock video for YouTube, because I used stock video for YouTube for about a year before I started investing in Epidemic Sound.
Ah, yeah. I use Epidemic Sound as well.
I just use the crappy YouTube audio files whenever.
Well, don't you find it interesting when you're watching another video, you go, I know that song. I use that song.
Or people will comment on them if I use it. They'll go, hey, that's so-and-so's theme song. How come you're using that?
So how quickly before, so you've uploaded the first video. Hey, was this the thing? Like, did you start uploading weekly? Did you know the cadence? Did you lean into it, or...
Well, I didn't lean into it at the beginning. I really had no concept of what was viral. And when I launched that first long video, the economy block, I had no idea what was going to happen. You know, in your heart, you're thinking, oh, please go viral. But in my brain, I really didn't know what viral was. And I possibly, a couple little things triggered me to keep going. One was YouTube sent me just a form email saying, congratulations, you made 50 subscribers. And then, congratulations, you made 100. And that was just enough to keep me going till I got to a point where I realized, oh, I really do enjoy doing this. I think I'm going to figure out how to do it well. And I just dug in, and my first video when I changed it was 5 beginner mistakes, and then 5 sewing hacks with masking tape. And I was just going along that cadence of 5 this, 10 that, whatever, which really works well on for me on YouTube. But I can remember like this about 4 months after I changed, I probably had maybe 600, 675 subscribers. And I was trying to get to that magic 1,000, right? And I remember launching one video and I could see it was doing better, but I turned to my son, I thought, you know, I was hoping for 1,000 by Valentine's Day, but I think I'm going to have to think about June. But almost 5 minutes after I said that, a big online blog, quilting blog, picked up one of those videos. I think it was 5 sewing hacks with masking tape. And my subscriptions just went through. Wow. My followers just went through the roof. What are they called? Subscribers. Yeah. So my subscribers just went through the roof. And I was in this funny position where I had people coming to my channel, but I didn't have enough videos for them to watch. So it took me a long time to get to that magic watch time on my channel. I think I ended up with about 4,000 before I could monetize.
Wow. I remember those days. That seems like such a long time ago. When did you start experimenting with other things and it became like, this is, you know, when did the businesswoman part come about, or had that already been established beforehand, or is the businesswoman from, you know, building this YouTube channel and now this YouTube channel and the other parts of your brand are what you do for a living?
Well, my husband and I were in business for a long time, and we closed our business December 31st, 2019. Really good timing. We managed to get it closed a month before the pandemic hit. And I had done a lot of other jobs on the side too. I was a project manager. I was an inventory manager. And I knew how businesses ran. I know about profit and loss and balance sheets and things like that. But I also knew going into this that I had to be flexible. I'm at an age where my children may have also have children. I have older parents, and touch wood, they're healthy right now, but that could change at any second. And personally, I'm just in an age where I could get sick too. So I didn't want to dive deep into a brand. I wanted to build something that was flexible, so I could go on vacation and not worry about things. And YouTube was a really good fit for all that.
What was the motivation to make that first post with that new selfie stick? Who were you wanting to see this?
Well, being a quilter is a creative process, right? And there's people that just make quilts for themselves and for their family. And then there's people that want a profile and online. And there's some very, there's a very fuzzy line between artist and crafter. You know, when does one, when do you stop being a crafter and become an artist? Or do you ever go into the crafter? Maybe you just start off and you're an artist. So I mean, it sounds like I'm bragging or...
Oh, you can flex away on this show.
I wanted a presence, you know. I wanted to be... I really enjoyed quilting and I wanted to be part of the quilting world. And I had first looked at starting up a quilt shop that sold fabric and patterns, realized that was not for me. I could be a pattern designer. That was another angle, a pattern designer, a pattern teacher. But as I refocused my channel from just those first three videos that I made for my friends, I realized there was something that I brought to the table that I hadn't seen out there. Most quilting channels at that time were stores. So they were doing things for you to buy their product. And there's a very different part of your brain that you use when you buy the tools and the fabric and everything for quilting, and then the actual part of your brain that you use when you make it. So there's this disjointedness between all this fabric that you buy and the tools and everything and what you actually create with it. They don't actually match up a lot of the time. So we're always challenged with how do we use up what we have? instead of going to the store and buying something new, how do we use what we've had?
I can relate. Woodworking, same way.
Yeah. So that's what my channel is about, using what you have. What are the skills? What is stopping you from taking that fabric that you really, really liked? You walked into a store and you spent your hard-earned money on. How do you turn that into a quilt? And that's what my channel has become about. I show people how to use color. I show people how to use hacks. I just did a video on measuring hacks. What do you do? How do you measure if you don't like the math? How do you measure if you don't have a ruler? And those type of tricks.
I saw where you do this decluttering challenge. Is that something you've done for the past couple of years?
Yes, this is going to be my fourth year doing the challenge.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this because, like I mentioned, the woodworking is the exact same way. We get filled up with all these pieces of scrap lumber. And I was kind of inspired when I saw this thing that you're doing. And I'm like, wow, I wonder if I could bring that into woodworking for the new year. So lay it on me. Tell me how this thing works and what it accomplishes.
So that what I brought to the table was my inventory management skills. Like I used to go into businesses and take a look at their inventory, figured out where they were making their money, and cleaned out everything that wasn't making them money. Because a lot of people don't realize it, but business is about making your cash turn. It's not about going in and buying inventory that will keep you going for a year. You want to keep an inventory for 1 month and keep buying that over and over again. You want to have the right stock in the right place at the right time. And so I have a lot of experience about going in and cleaning things out and just focusing on what you like. So one of the things that has never been said before is, okay, so when you started, you bought this thingamajigger and it was very helpful for the first 2 years, but now you're 10 years down the road and you've replaced that thingamajigger with some other stuff. So why are you still holding on to that? It was useful at one time, but it's no longer useful.
How do you stop from bringing that stuff in? Because when you're in at the store and you're looking at all of the wonderful patterns or all of the aspirational, how do you like lock out the aspirational aspect of wanting to bring stuff in?
Well, I know there's we all have it. We all get that beautiful dopamine hit when you bring something new home. But then there's a whole collection of shame and everything that comes with it when you just kind of stuff it in a closet because you don't know what you're going to do with it.
Good point.
One of the questions that, like, if you were just decluttering your closet of clothes, you would be asking yourself the question, does this still fit? Am I going to wear it? Do I still like it? And you could have the answer be yes to those things when you look at, in quilting, it's fabric. Let's just say we're talking about fabric. Yeah, I kind of like that fabric. But the real question is, do you want to make something of it? It's not whether you like it. It doesn't matter whether you could actually sometime in some fantasy future make something out of it. Does that thing actually inspire you to make something? Trying to keep only those things that inspire you around.
Do you have an organization system for your YouTube content? As in like your ideas and like how does a video end up coming about?
Yeah, how cluttered is your YouTube thoughts?
It's pretty cluttered. There's no way I can make a quilt every week for a video. Very early on, I realized that I had to, instead of focusing on a project, focusing on an aspect that project, a skill or something that you needed to be able to handle while you were making that project is the way to go. So instead of saying, okay, here's how you make this pattern, I go to here's how you can cut accurately. So this turns out the way you want it to be. But that said, sometimes I can be working on something and it's hard and my brain will throw up, well, why don't you do this video instead? And very often I can be making a very hard term right. I'll be thinking this is the project I'm working on, but something else can come up. And sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's not. sometimes I think, oh, how am I going to make this YouTube channel last for a couple more years? But then there's no end to ideas. My idea board has at least 100 videos on it.
Has it affected your interest in quilting?
What it has done, and I have to keep refocusing and making sure that I'm making what I want to make as opposed to what people are asking for. There's that Venn diagram of what you want to do and what people want to watch and that magic middle
right,
where they overlap. Right at the moment, there's a big quilt show for the modern quilters in February every year called QuiltCon. And I have yet to enter that show. And I've just been going through that moment where, darn it, I wish I had more time so I could be super creative and make something that could enter that show. Not necessarily get chosen, but something that's worthy of being entered. And I find that that is lacking in my life.
Oh, I can totally relate to that. There's so many things that I would like to make, but I kind of think, well, will this fit into a YouTube video? It's like video first for everything. Are you familiar with the 80-20 concept?
Yes.
I've heard a lot of YouTubers talking about this. Like 80% of the content is for, I guess, the audience. 20% you just do for you.
But you also have to be careful of the 80-20 rule works in reverse as well. You know, you can have 20% of your viewers complaining or begging you or whatever and giving you 80% of your headaches. So you've just, for me, I've...
That's true.
That's sage words right there.
So I have become quite focused with my viewers. There's I'm dealing with a demographic that sometimes is computer challenged and YouTube challenged. You know, they know how to press play, but they don't know how to do anything else. They have no concept of the closed captions or the speed button or even the fact that you could watch it a second time.
Yeah.
You went too fast. And instead of dealing with all those issues, I realize, you know what? Those are not the people that I'm speaking to. I'll help them in a limited amount of way, but I'm not going to stop everything I'm doing to give them IT support.
Yeah. So are you going to try to enter something into this exhibition?
It's too late for this year.
Okay.
But I'm thinking hard for next year.
Would that be like incorporated into your channel, like, you know, follow along as I'm doing this thing? Or is this just something you want to do just to clear your mind and just do quilting?
I want to do some projects that are more challenging for myself. Now, if I was entering it into a quilt show, the problem is I think I would need a little bit of privacy around it. Privacy to work on it and do it the way I want to do it. So when it's entered in a show, nobody recognizes it, right?
Oh, I see. Right.
The other project that's in the back, my brain has already mapped it out. I just don't have the hours to devote to writing it down and getting it down on paper. Is I have a book that I would like to write.
Oh.
But YouTube is busy. As you know, there's a lot for every minute on.
There's never enough hours. No. It's impossible to do everything I want to do. What's your book going to be about? Just like entry level quilting, or what do you have in mind for that?
It would be about quilting skills, just some quilt projects that would just move them along in their skill level.
Can I ask why you don't have a book, Steve? Just on behalf of people who might be wondering, like, you've been doing this for 150 years and you haven't written a book at this point? Well,
this is something I've thought a lot about. I have given it a lot of thought, and it's something that I kind of desperately want to do is write a book. But at the same time, it's hard for me to justify the time versus how much money a book can bring in. And, you know, it's not... Nobody except like the top level authors are writing books to really make much money. At least that's been my experience talking to a lot of different authors. They're like, well, it was a great experience, but I'm no James Patterson.
And you have your video programs and whatnot. That does make sense. Can I ask, Karen, do you pay much attention to YouTube analytics? Do you like go in the creator studio and muddle about, or do you not pay attention to that stuff?
I do. I take a look at them, and I certainly go to YouTube Studio once a day to check on how my videos are doing and the watch time and things like that. But I don't go into the nitty gritty and say, oh, look at this video. People stopped watching at this point, because my videos just normally people watch the whole thing. My videos are about 12 to 15 minutes long, and people are in it for a coffee break, right? So, and a lot of people don't know how to hit that stop button. So my analytics per video don't change very much, but I do notice the keywords that pull people in. So scraps, quilt as you go.
Yeah.
Declutter. My declutter challenge is popular at the beginning of the year. But one thing that I discovered with the declutter challenge and just sort of the cadence of videos, there's that core group of people that watch every single video I put out. So once a week, they sit down and they watch it, and they'll often even show up for my podcast twice a month. If I did more than one a week, they may not watch everything because that's just too much. They don't have the time. But when I did the 21-day declutter challenge, there was that smaller group of people that showed up every single day. So each video didn't make as much money as my weekly video, but 7 days of that made more money than one video.
Everybody just has this need to declutter. So it's not surprising that that would be something, especially at the beginning of the year with New Year's resolutions. It's like, man, I got to get my life in order and start to declutter. How does the challenge part of that work? Is it just kind of an informal, I'm challenging you to clear out your stuff, or is there an actual kind of structure to this?
There is a structure in... There's a structure in how I choose categories for every single day. And I tell them, you know, you're working 15 minutes at a time just to unclutter this one particular category. So I know a fair amount about brain science and how our brains work. And I know that people process information differently, and making choices, just making the choice, do I keep this or don't I keep it, is very taxing on the brain. You can do it once, but when you have to do it for 50 things, you can be totally exhausted by the end of it. So I'm encouraging people to do it category by category, like declutter your pens today, declutter your paper tomorrow, because when you go through all of one category, you're just asking the same question over and over again. And it's easy to answer that question. Yes, no, we're dealing with paper. But if you go into a drawer and you've got a hard drive and you've got glasses and you've got old electronics, you have a much bigger mental load making all those different choices.
And it takes a bit of soul searching for all of these kind of moments, because we have these emotional attachments to even something as simple as paper that we've had around for years. And well, someday I might use it. And I remember when I bought it and it was very special.
But you've also got the other questions of, okay, I don't want it. So what am I going to do with it? Am I recycling it? Am I giving it to someone? Oh, it costs a lot of money, so I should probably try to give it to someone.
And just throwing it away feels so wrong.
You get into these spirals. And you'll burn out if you do the drawer by drawer method. So that's the organizational. That's what I bring to the table for the declutter challenge. Today, this is what we're working on. And you possibly have this as well, Steve. Somebody's passed away and you're a woodworker, so you probably want all this woodworking stuff that my special person left behind. And it's filled with all sorts of stuff you don't need. But you now have this emotional, oh, I don't want them to think I don't appreciate the effort, or
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I love this person too, and how much of it should I hang on to?
And because something was important to them, you kind of feel like, well, it has to be important to me too.
Yeah. But how much do you have to keep to remind yourself of that person? You don't need to keep the whole shebang. Those needles that they never used, there's a reason why they never used those things. They didn't work.
They were crappy needles.
So why do you have to hang on to them?
Yeah, it's true. It's so true.
Can I ask who does your thumbnails?
I do.
Yay, those are great thumbnails. Is there something that you, it looks like you take your thumbnails separately? Like, do you have the idea of what it's going to look like before you make the video like we're supposed to do?
Occasionally. Occasionally, I do get the horse before the cart. But unfortunately, so much of it is, oh, I finally got the video done. And then, oh, darn it, I got to do a thumbnail for it.
Yeah, I got to.
I know. That's me every time.
And then you realize you should have taken the thumbnail at the beginning of the project as opposed to the end. And yeah, the thumbnail, I know it's so critical. And I feel I have a style in my thumbnail that people know that it's me. They're not confusing it with anybody else. But there's still the challenge of how do you make it clever?
Just copy Mr. Beast. Everybody does.
Big, big, huge smile with comically white teeth is the secret. Karen's Quilt Circle, September 2020. You have about 60 episodes. It seems like what was your standalone podcast idea at a time? Was that something that you still do it? What do you like about that space as opposed to like making YouTube videos? Or is there any difference?
There is. I realized I was not the expert on everything. I have my areas, and there's a lot of people out there that have been quilting for a long time, or they've just started, but they're doing something different. And it indulges my curiosity. I get into history, which I really enjoy. I get into people that have tried something different. You know, they've only been quilting for 2 years, but they've hit the ground running. How did they do that? There's a person in our industry that's super well known. Her name is Tula Pink. And I interviewed her because she's done such an incredible job of creating her brand. But people don't understand the effort that's gone into it. So I really kind of dug into, okay, so how did you do it? Like, you weren't always this way. How did that experience build up? What's the support behind you? And just, I'm just so happy people show up.
Because it's a place that you can be more selfish. Like, this is like, I get to get something out of this, and I get to ask the questions and whatnot. And
yeah,
it's what I absolutely love about doing this podcast. We talk about it all the time. Like, this ends up becoming a safe space every week to talk to other creators. So,
well, I interviewed, just an example of how you can even take it a little bit farther. I interviewed a Hawaiian woman a couple of years ago. There's a technique of quilting called Hawaiian quilting, very distinct from other types. And as I was talking to her, I was going, wouldn't it be great to take a Hawaiian quilting class in Hawaii taught by a Hawaiian? And that's why I was just in Hawaii.
Oh, wow. So that was, oh, that's, there was many reasons for that.
Tax deduction. There you go.
You went to QuiltCon. I mean, so aptly named. Have you ever thought about VidCon, or have you ever gone to
I don't know which one to go to. VidCon is just, I don't know where to get started. I would really like to have to go with someone to one of these things so they can hold my hand.
You can go with us. Okay. I'll take you along.
When's the next one?
Next June. And if you want to go, we'll all go. We had a lot of fun last time.
Yeah. But we just have to get invited into the secret
YouTube.
Yeah.
Or the secret VidCon.
It's okay, though.
Do we need orange gold plaques for that, maybe? Or the diamond?
We also are very, very creative people. Like, we're all kind of artistic. So I think we can probably make our own fake passes to get into wherever we want to go. But either way, let's make this happen. Let's get as many people and let's do it up again at VidCon. However, I bring that up because I have bumped into you now numerous times at different YouTube events. So you have a YouTube partner manager and you have... How long have you had a partner manager for?
Not that long. I've had her for just over a year. But I've really enjoyed working with her because I have questions about Google and YouTube and how it all works. And because she talks to other YouTubers as well, she often will say, well, this person has done something like that. Not disclosing anything private, but maybe you could take a look at that channel and see how they've done it.
Right.
And, you know, I get on the ground floor on certain things. I get invited to nice events down at Google, which I love. Yeah. Meeting people like you, Chad, and the McCain dog guys. And there was a couple of – at the last event we were at, there were a number of women who have had a lot of success in YouTube there as well. I got up to and was able to fangirl over them.
And you're also quite a sport when it comes to like them dishing out like, hey, you should be on shorts. Hey, you should do lives. Hey, you should go and use your community tab and whatnot. I see on your channel, you try all of this stuff. Have you had any success with shorts?
We were talking about this at that last event. And I think the light bulb thing for me was when I'm doing shorts, I'm appealing to a different demographic. And if I'm interested in growing my channel, that's one way for that demographic to discover me. My core demographic is not necessarily watching shorts, but if I'm wanting to pull in more from outside in the bigger community, shorts is possibly the way to go. So I've been looking at it just differently. Instead of, you know, taking a video that I have and trying to resplice it so I can put it up as a short, take another aspect of the subject and film it in that vertical format and get it online. And not necessarily aiming for 60 seconds. It can be 15 and it can be 30.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is freeing because, I mean, you do try a lot of things. Why don't you do more lives? It seems like a live would be a wonderful thing. Or is it just a timing thing? We don't have enough time for these things.
I used to do a live every month and I'll do a lot. I'm back on track, but I had a couple of health issues earlier this year. And it affected my jaw. It was very painful and I'm now on medication for it and touch wood, all is well. But I just didn't feel I could take the chance being on live and it flaring up on me. But I do love live, but I don't have an assistant right at the moment. I lost my VA at the beginning of the year. She went on to bigger and better things, and I hired another one. Unfortunately, she had some health problems and had to leave, and I just haven't been able to find that good replacement.
Got it. I saw a post that you put on your community tab about looking for a social media person or an assistant in that way. Like, how overwhelming is it for you right now as far as like trying to manage everything without help?
It is. It's overwhelming. So I've cut back on some things. Like, I don't put out a newsletter right at the moment. I'm not posting to Facebook and Instagram as much as I used to. I'm just focused on doing the stuff for the YouTube channel. I have an editor who can do a first draft for me. Sometimes she can even do a second draft for me if I have all my ducks in line and I can get her all the footage in time. But I don't have anybody. I'm wanting to have somebody close so that they can come in and help me with those thumbnail photos and they can help me with those, with just doing description. I mean, part of the reason why I haven't written a book is I actually find writing very hard and it's just hard to write copy. It's very easy to edit that copy, but really hard to get that first draft down. So just trying to, it's difficult, but I've cut back so that it's not difficult.
I have a question about quilting. Is this, I've always heard that quilting started as just a way to get rid of scrap fabric. Is that the case? Is that how the whole kind of art and craft came to be?
So quilting is older than that. Quilting actually, in the past, quilting has been the sandwich. You know, you have a top, you have batting in the middle, and then you have a back. And that batting used to be made out of wool. Sometimes it was made out of old socks. Sometimes it was just whatever they had around. It could have been even an older blanket. And there used to be journeyman quilters that went from town to town. And people would be making the quilts for the people for their next winter. They would stay with the family for a couple of days. They often traveled in pairs, and they would quilt whatever was available, some woven goods, and they would take the time and put it together. When cotton became plentiful, and that was in the early 1800s, when anybody could have several different outfits because cotton just became so much it was so much more expensive than wool before the cotton gin and that processing came into be. And suddenly there was cotton everywhere. So people would have these scraps left over from making shirts and dresses and aprons and everything. And they found patchwork for those. But there's also very much two different paths to quilting. So there's the people that had these scraps and they were putting them together and making blankets. And then you had wealthy women that had time on their hands and they were quilting for skill. Like to show off their skills. They were great with embroidery. And somewhere along the line in the 1800s, being good at needlework became synonymous with being a good and worthy woman. If you didn't have good, it was really something that you had to pursue in just to be thought of as a good person.
It was kind of expected of the woman of the house.
Yeah. Next to godliness. Yeah.
So today it seems like that there is, like you were mentioning earlier, this, and it's not a divide, but there's this duality between the art and the craft of quilting. And I think you see this a lot. And I go to the county fair every summer, and there's like a quilting guild there. And they're all they're incredibly beautiful quilts, but they're not useful quilts, you know? Mm-hmm. They're like small in a way. They're meant to hang on a wall as a work of art. So do people tend to come down, quilters come down on one side or the other, kind of pursue either the artistic or the craft, or is there usually more of a blending of that?
I think you've got people that join quilting because they've just moved into a new town, they're older, they don't have any kids in school, so how do you connect with other people? You join a quilt guild and you have this circle of people and you have no real aspirations to be an amazing quilter. You just want to make blankets for everybody in your family because blankets surround people and armor people. They enclose them in warmth and love. And it's just a really nice thing to do for people.
I love the way you talk about that.
And there's other people that they might be very artistic, but I find there's a lot of women who have attained a certain level within their professions. You know, they've been a big lawyer or a doctor, or you know, they ran the hospital or something, and they're not looking, if when they dive into this craft, they're looking for a higher profile. They want to be taken seriously with it, and they pursue the artistic side of it. And then you have this middle where people come and go, you know, as time permits, where you try to make the best thing you can make. But if it has some mistakes, don't care. I can enter it into my local quilt show if I want to, but I'm not aiming for the blue ribbon. I just want to be in the show.
Where do you personally fall on that spectrum between artist and craftsperson?
I think I consider myself an artist, but I don't consider my when I make a quilt, if somebody asks me to make a quilt for them, I charge them a good penny for it. I take my hours seriously.
It's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time. So I'm charging thousands of dollars for a quilt because that's how much time it takes.
But it's an heirloom piece.
Yes. It's something that I'm making a quilt for as a wedding present for someone or for a new home or something. So it is meant to last for a long time. But I haven't had the time to really dive into a particular aspect of it and go deeply into it. I try for precision. I try for, I always try to something different with every quilt. And even if I'm following a pattern, like I'm working with other people, I'll always be modifying it to work with the way I want to work. And I've gone very deeply into color, and I'm always experimenting with how colors play with each other. But I think I'm at the beginning steps of an artist, but I'm not, I just haven't had that time to invest to make my, like if I had a black belt, if I was working towards a black belt, I would say I'm still down, I would be somewhere between an orange and a blue.
Is there any like computer quilting machines now that people are using?
There are.
Is that a controversial topic?
It's going to become even more than it is now. We have something like a CNC machine for our quilting. So there's a long arm and you can do it freehand, but we now have computers that you can program into a design for on top.
Do you have an opinion on all this?
Well, it's going to get harder and harder for some of these shows because, well, let me step back a bit. Back in 1985, the biggest show in the world, the quilt show in the world, is in Houston. And quilting is very, very big in Texas. And the first person that had the best in show was made with a domestic sewing machine as opposed to being hand quilted. And I was told that there were people crying in the aisles because quilting was going downhill from there.
Wow.
Quilting should have been a hand thing. Now it's being made on sewing machines and long arms. That was a big changing point. And now we're at that point where quilts have these patterns on them that are like the quilting part of it can be computerized. There's actually stitching in it that you can do on a embroidery machine. And yeah, I've looked at many quilts and going, oh, a human didn't do this. This is just too precise. This is just too perfect. And that's one of the things about not entering a quilt show. You can stand back and judge it a certain way. And if I was competing against one of those quilts, I think I would be hurt that I was being, I didn't win because they used a computer and I did not.
Right.
But it takes an incredible amount of talent as well to program the computer.
And to design to do that work. Yeah.
So
yeah,
I don't want to take, by saying that, I don't want to say that it's effortless. It's just a different type of effort.
It's two separate things, right? Yeah. Yeah, we see the same thing in woodworking. There is a little bit of this controversy there about how much of it should be handmade and how much of it is relying on computers or other machines. And I think it's just a spectrum. We just kind of find our way and do whatever makes us happy. I think that a lot of it comes down to, and this is would be a question for you, does quilting, do you find the process of quilting the most enjoyable part or just kind of being able to have that completed quilt?
My brain loves the first part of making a quilt. It loves the planning and the twirling in my mind.
Then when you're 1,000 hours into it, you're like, oh my God.
The 1,000 hours of thinking about it before you ever cut anything. And I do like the actual cutting of fabric. I like that those motions. And I have a fair amount of skill now that I can make pretty accurate blocks. But after that, I lose a lot of interest. It is just everything I can do to get those blocks together. It quilted, it bound. I hate it more and more with every second that I work on it. And I'm going, okay, let's just pace ourselves so we can get to the end. And then once the binding comes on, it just transforms. It's no longer pieces of fabric. It becomes a quilt. And it's quite a magical moment.
Well, you just need a machine to take over that tedious stuff.
But there's other people. There's other people that don't like planning at all. There's people that will buy a pattern and they will follow it to the T.
Mm-hmm.
I had a situation where recently where I designed something and sent it off. We were looking at different pictures. Do you want it this way? Do you want it this way? Do you want it this way? And they decided on version number 3, but I did not go back and correct a mistake that I found on version number 3. And the person that took it and delivered it to everyone didn't see the mistake. And every single person that received it made it with the mistake in it, where I went, oh, that's a mistake. Oh, this obviously is supposed to be this color. But I was the only one that made that call.
As we all slowly get drawn into our phones more and more, do you see the popularity of an analog activity like quilting growing or receding in the future?
COVID was very good for quilting. Everybody had to stop and they rediscovered hobbies. Thousands of people made masks and scrub caps. And they had to do something with all the extra fabric. But even people went to knitting, they went to woodworking, they just gardening, all these wonderful hobbies. People realized there was a place for those things in their lives. And I think once you discover a hobby, you realize how important it is for mental health. Because so much of life is taking away from your energy, and your hobby is where you get it back. It fulfills you. It fills your bucket. I use that term often. Can a video game do that? Can swiping a screen do that? No, it can't. And I think it's going to be a struggle for people to move away from that. Because they do get that dopamine hit as they swipe or click or all those different things. So I think it will be harder for people to move into hobbies unless they have a history of hobby in their family.
I think it takes a lot of introspection too, to kind of have that desire for something greater than you're currently experiencing. And hobbies such as handmade things offer that.
Well, the wonderful thing about right now is there's YouTube. You know, if you want to learn to make fuzzy wool thingamajigs, there's a YouTube channel for it. If you dig out an old handheld sewing machine, you know, do you remember those K-Tel ones where you could...
I remember that. Yeah, on the TV. Yeah.
There's YouTube videos for those.
Right alongside the Pocket Fisherman. And then the button maker. Remember it would snap buttons on.
Yes, yes, I remember that thing too.
Have you ever seen the AIDS Memorial Quilt?
The AIDS Memorial Quilt is a big one, yes.
So that thing it's like, I was just looking it up before the podcast, and it's got, apparently today, it is 54 tons and has 50,000 panels and is dedicated to more than 110,000 people.
That was a huge, huge project.
I can't imagine something that big. And that here it is like 35 years later and it's still happening, I guess.
Quilters do that all the time. I'm going to say a number here that's just going to blow your mind. But during World War II, Canadian quilters, sent over 400,000 quilts to Europe. That's just World War II. And we're not talking about a country that has the population that we have today. 400,000 quilts is an incredible amount. But anytime there's a tragedy, just recently we had it, the forest fires in Maui, the forest fires up in Northwest Territories. I participate in a group called Quilts for Survivors, where they're giving a quilt to any person who survived the residential school system or a family member survived it. And, you know, these projects are wonderful in being able to share that warmth and security with people who have lost it.
It's a lot more than just making a blanket. There's this emotional level of quilting that seems to have been around since day one.
Yes. And, you know, when people went off or a bride went off with her wedding quilt, it would be filled with fabrics that had been part of their life. And
that's so nice.
I just even know with my own children, I didn't make quilts when they were small, but there were patterns on the quilts and they knew we made up stories about the patterns in the quilt. And those things just stay around. I had a friend, unfortunately, her sister-in-law passed away. Her husband's sister passed away. And as they were clearing out the contents of her condo, this corner of a blanket appeared underneath the bed. And she said her husband just leaped across the room because he recognized this quilt that his grandmother used to have in their cabin in the woods. He hadn't seen it since he was 15, but this was something that he really, really wanted because he had all these memories of a child playing underneath it, sleeping with his grandmother. And it's just a scrappy, scrappy thing, but he loved it. And that was the thing that he wanted most.
When Riley was born, or actually leading up to Riley being born, we announced the pregnancy.
Oh my God.
On our YouTube channel.
Oh wow!
Wow!
Send us this beautiful quilt. It's huge, actually. And I'd never seen anything quite like it. It's literally like out of everything that we've ever been sent from, like fans sending us stuff. To just like the most unexpected, just like random gift. This is it. We have it, and you can just appreciate. And this is great for a podcast, obviously. But it's just all these wonderful little animals and whatnot. And I was just so inspired by it, and especially when you shared the to wrap yourself in just like it's a blanket. I get it. It's just a blanket, but like. There's so much more to that blanket, and it's almost inspiring. And I don't even know if it made me want to try doing a quilt, but what would you say to someone who is interested in learning to be able to do it, just to actually be able to do it, not to become a lifelong quilter or whatnot? I see the functionality in like learning how to sew and wanting to like learn how to mend my own clothes and whatnot. And I'm wondering, do you do that yourself?
I am trying to get back into it. I used to make all my own clothes. And when I say all, I'm talking about my outer clothes. I'm not talking about underwear or anything like that, or parkas or things like that. I'm just talking about shirts and dresses and things like that. But sure. For new people, I always tell them start small, because making a quilt is a triathlon. Like the skills that you need to start it, to make the middle, and to finish it off are three totally different skill sets.
I'm sure.
So you want to start small, one, so that you know if you really want to do it, two, it's less expensive, and three, you know, you just get through it faster. There's so much that you learn making that first quilt. And I'm talking as a person who started off with a king. It took 10 years to finish.
I saw your soccer, but those soccer balls are the best. How long does it take to do a soccer ball?
Well, if you know what you're doing, it took me a day. And I filmed it as well. So it doesn't, that was made on a sewing machine, the soccer ball. The smaller ones, like this one here, this one probably took me about a week.
Wow.
Sitting in front of the TV making it. But this is handmade, that one. That's the difference.
Do you have like a callus on your thumbs and fingers from pushing needles through fabric?
I don't, because I use a thimble.
Oh, okay.
When I first started, I thought, thimbles are for wimps. Nope, there's a reason why you use a thimble.
Yeah, you don't develop those leather fingertips, huh?
Well, I'll have a question for you, Steve. Do you have all your fingers?
I do, all 10 of them. No, I'm careful.
There you go.
That would be a bad branding if I lost a finger.
It would, but you have 10 chances, so you'd be okay. I guess I brought it up because my thought was I'm trying to talk myself into getting a sewing machine because I'm starting to understand, like, it seems to be a skill like I should have followed through after Cub Scouts and learned how to do it, especially because I have a hole in the shirt. I have a hole in a sweater and you take it to a thing and it's $45 in 3 days or whatever it is to do something, which I think is just like this wonderful. So I guess I'm asking, is it worth the investment in me getting a small sewing
machine? Yeah, you don't
need
to buy new. You can buy a used one and get a perfectly good used one.
That's a good point.
And that was another thing about COVID. You know, people brought out, you know, their grandmother's sewing machine and started using them. And the old ones are very, very good. And just test it out. And it's a great skill to teach your children.
It also, I think it will also teach children that we don't have to replace everything because it's damaged, that we can actually fix things.
Visible mending is a really popular thing now. Repairing holes in sweaters, repairing holes in jeans and things like that. And it's true, you know, and you can cut up your clothes and make a quilt or make another item out of it.
That's fantastic. Yeah, in this age of fast fashion, I think it's really refreshing to think about this.
Do you have a plan? Do you have a goal? Do you have, in 1 year, I'm going to start doing this? Or are you just going to continue with your trajectory?
I've had to slow down a bit since I had this problem with my jaw this year and just sort of deal with where's the future. And I realize I'm living the back 50 years of my life now. I've done the first 50. I'm on the back 50 now. And getting old sucks. People don't tell you about all the things. It's not just about wrinkles. It's about other things too. So I don't know whether, Steve, you may have this problem in woodworking too, with so many people get arthritis and they can't actually handle the tools anymore. Our eyes get bad and we can't see the work anymore. So how much longer do I want to do this? And again, possibility, I maybe need it within my family for babysitting or taking people to doctor's appointments and things like that. So I'm still trying to be flexible. So I still have... I know what I don't want to do. I've looked at it again and realized I didn't want to double down in being a brand that had items to sell. Really didn't want to do, did not want to do inventory and that burden. But I realized that I haven't done everything I've wanted to do in quilting. And part of the declutter challenge for me this year will be to continue to get rid of all those projects that came into my life thinking, oh, maybe I'll do that, and realize, no, don't want to do that anymore. This is the way that I'd like to do it. So I do have a goal of entering a quilt show, but it's not so much entering the quilt show, but doing quilts that really push me. Choosing some projects that really take me off in directions that make me happy.
Creatively speaking, and yeah. You're looking at more creative, artistic quilts?
Well, I'm preferring to call it mentally challenging.
Okay.
Push my own, I don't want to do things that don't make me happy. You look at quilts and you can say, oh, that's beautiful. but that's not what I want to make.
Right. Yeah. I would imagine a lot of it comes down to just how laborious it becomes, like you were mentioning earlier, when you get into those tedious sections of doing things over and over again. Perhaps that's something you're trying to scale back.
Yeah. So I don't have a 5-year plan. I don't have a 10-year plan. I'm kind of working it year by year.
I think that's valid. I think it's perfectly fine for people on YouTube or whoever's creating media to just let it happen. Be in the moment, enjoy what you're doing at the time, and know that a lot of people are getting a lot of enjoyment out of everything you produce. Karen, it was great having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.